This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2023 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us for Socialism 2024, which will be held in Chicago next Labor Day weekend, August 30th through September 2nd. It's never too early to make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
So this session is going to be probably a little bit different than the other ones you've been to at Socialism, because we are going to present a little bit and talk at you at the beginning, but it's also more like a workshop. We're going to have a little bit of an interactive activity and discussion, hopefully together. Mon and I are both organizers. We're not historians. We're not experts. We really wanted to look into the history of carceral reform in New York to see about what lessons it could teach us for our organizing. And so this is like research we've done together, and we are sharing it with you all to also learn with you all. So it's more like a collaborative learning project and less of us teaching you all anything. We really wanted to know like how history can be a tool for our organizing. So today, like just a basic overview of what we're going to be doing. First, Mon and I are going to do some like larger framing and also level setting of like terms and definitions. And then we're going to go into the activity, all these images or pieces of paper you see around the room, and then discussion. So I'll pass it to Mon.
Yeah, thank you. So there will be like a part of this where I'm just reading and talking, and that will be probably for about the next 10 minutes. But we wanted to just do some framing for what this analysis is and what we're going to be doing today. So responses to the 2020 uprisings and demands for transformation as well as abolition have revolved around decarceration, defund, decriminalization, and violence intervention at interpersonal, community, and institutional levels. Many of these have focused on divesting from violence and investing in care, which can look like cops out of schools, funding for public housing, free healthcare, and student debt cancellation. Other demands have focused directly on police, corrections, courts, family policing, border policing, psychiatric incarceration, and more. The mainstreaming of abolitionist concepts in the past decade has resulted in a level of what we observe as co-optation, ahistoricism, and pacification rooted in expansion of state violence. Some of these come directly from the police and state. Some of these are earnest proposals with troubling possible outcomes, and some come from academic, philanthropic, and nonprofit organizations with muddled aims and problematic histories. We just wanted to like have an important note on earnest proposals. There's really good reasons why organizers, advocates, directly impacted people, and community members make demands for resources and policies through and or related to the courts. Our communities have been so divested from, sometimes these kinds of fixes, often discussed as harm reduction, seem like the only viable option for achieving any kind of investment. We honor that and take it seriously, while also knowing that these kinds of solutions, while perhaps offering potential relief on an individual level, aren't going to get us closer to where we want to be collectively. As anti-capitalist abolitionists, we're keen to understand which demands, specifically affirmative demands, for the things we want and need are the most effective in this political, economic, and social landscape, and which demands produce what we understand as false solutions that contribute to net widening, carceral creep, carceral expansion, and the many other frameworks people have used to study and describe what happens to be ever-increasing criminalization, social control, coercion, supervision, and incarceration alongside normalized neoliberal governance. And how many folks went to the critical resistance workshop or talk? Did anyone go? Okay, so you might recognize some of the frameworks we use here because we're learning and borrowing from our comrades. And because prison industrial complex abolition is our overarching framework, when we are thinking about any kind of reform, we're interested in reforms that not only reduce the number of people in cages, but reforms that shrink the size, scope, resources, power, and legitimacy of the entire criminal punishment system, which includes cops, courts, cages, surveillance, supervision, and so on. We know that not everyone here necessarily identifies as an abolitionist, but for the purposes of our conversation, this framework of shrinking the overall system is our horizon. It's going to be important to keep that in mind as our guiding principle. And then the other kind of like past personal example I wanted to give is that I really got into pretrial detention, you know, focusing on pretrial detention through organizing around jail construction, jail expansion, and the closure of Rikers. And one of the things that was really frustrating, both in the fight in New York around Rikers and also other fights around the country, is that, you know, we could all agree, like, we don't need this jail, the jail should be shut down, but then where the conversation went after that, how to get people out, how to reduce the number of people inside, what should happen instead, what should happen with the building, seemed to be just a complicated area of contestation. In New York, they decided to build 4 new jails, but in addition to that, you know, there's been so many different kinds of expansions of pretrial services in the last 5 years, and these are all framed as decarceration. We're going to get into that more today, but that directly led into this line of kind of thinking and questioning that we're, you know, holding today.
Yeah, and like like Mon, this is relevant to things that I've been involved with historically too. Before I became an organizer at Community Justice Exchange, I was the director of a bail fund in Brooklyn during especially the height, I mean, it's still ongoing, bail reform conversations, but in the mid-2010s, much of which you're going to see documented in this timeline. And that's where I really first encountered this question, if not bail or if not pretrial detention, then what? And typically the solution proposed was some form of supervision, some like alternative to cages. Hardly ever was it suggested that the solution could just be freedom. No cages, no money, no programs, no electronic shackles, just freedom when someone fights their case. And for many, like especially in New York, and this was a lot of conversations with mostly mainstream criminal justice groups that were working on legislative reform, the reason why freedom wasn't suggested was often because freedom just didn't seem winnable. In order to get money bail or certainly pretrial detention, something would need to exist in its place. But, you know, is that actually true? And does the creation of these alternatives bring us anywhere closer to liberation, much less abolition? I will say here in Chicago, obviously, there's a really amazing bill that was passed that has gotten rid of, well, hopefully in the next couple of weeks as it's implemented, gets rid of money bail. And they've done a lot of work to safeguard the bill and prevent against this expansion of supervision, but Illinois is pretty unique in that space right now. Additionally, what led us to do this project is because Mon and I, we believe in the autonomy and freedom of criminalized people and in widespread access to housing, healthcare, food, education. And so we wanted to understand better why or how New York's economic history, what it reveals about its history of pretrial reform and vice versa, how these things are related. Because the city incarcerates some of the largest numbers of people in the world and is home to the largest pretrial penal colony, it's often the origin of carceral innovations that become common practice in municipalities across the country. So we were really wondering, like, how can we fight to end neoliberal racial capitalism as we fight for abolition? So a quick thing on why we chose New York City, it's not just because we live there, although that does help. but it's because the austerity policies that New York City officials adopted in reaction to the 1975 fiscal crisis set the standard for neoliberal policies across the country. And because New York City is one of the earliest sites of, quote, mass incarceration. Like many others, I bet many of you in this room, we take issue with the term mass incarceration, both because it belies the fact that specifically Black, brown, and poor people are the populations who were and continue to be hyper-criminalized and incarcerated, but also because the term implies that incarceration is only bad if it happens to a lot of people. And we disagree with both of those things. But when we're using it in this presentation because it's a term people recognize, but also because it refers to a period of time, specifically the mid-1970s, when there began like this prison building boom and the numbers of people in cages began to skyrocket due to changes in policies around criminalization and sentencing, as well as dramatic increases in arrests. So while this history of carceral reform in New York City is the case study we're going to use today, the lessons like apply across geographies. We want what we're showing you today to be a starting point, but that our discussion doesn't need to be limited to New York City. Like, we totally want you to name examples from your own places to bring this back to your own places. We're not trying to be myopic about New York City, but just that's what we know, that's what we looked at, and we do think there are things to learn. And so we see like this timeline as a contribution to a long history of organizing and writing about carceral reform. And we've learned a lot from others who have done in-depth analysis of New York City's carceral history. We were hoping Jared could be here today. Jared Shanahan, he's a historian who's written this awesome book called Captives. It's about the history of Rikers Island. Totally check it out if you're into histories of penal colonies. But we rely on a lot of his work for these facts. And his collaborator, John Akerti, they've written States of Incarceration together. There's plenty of like actual historians you could read who have amazing work. We are not historians, we're not experts. What we're sharing today is like an incomplete history. I was lucky to go to the carceral sanism session yesterday. I don't know if anyone else went. But Liat Ben-Moshe and Leah Harris did, I mean, Liat is a historian, and they were talking about the history of deinstitutionalization also in New York City at the same time period. You're not going to see that information on this timeline, even though it's super related, but encourage you to read their stuff. You know, these are all things that are relevant. We just had to sort of focus on a specific story and encourage you to, like, check out other histories that overlap. We also welcome, like, you all may know a lot more about the history or have your own experiences and are going to be curious to hear from you guys. Okay. Hey, Chen. Welcome, guys. So now we're going to move into definitions and, like, some level setting. And we wanted to do that just because we know that folks in this room are coming from a range of knowing a ton about pretrial detention and bail and whatever, and maybe very little to nothing at all. And so we just want to make sure that when we're using language, you understand the term, like what we're talking about. And like, for example, we're going to use the term alternatives a lot. A lot of other sessions at Socialism use the word alternative in a positive sense as like, you know, world creation, the things we want. When we're using it, it's often in a negative sense. And we'll explain more about why, but just it feels important to be clear about our language. And so before I do like a criminal court 101, I'm curious if anyone here, and I know there are people here, we'd love to know what you guys already know about pretrial supervision, surveillance, and alternatives to incarceration. So if anyone feels open to it, we'd love, you know, just a couple people to share. Like, what do you already know? It could be about the things we're gonna be talking are pretrial supervision, diversion, specialty courts, alternatives to incarceration. How would you explain what those kinds of programs are to someone who maybe doesn't know anything? Or you could even reference programs in your place, like where you're from. So just like a couple volunteers, who wants to share? Ah, oh, great, my God, Julia.
Do you want me to go to the mic?
Maybe, or you can use this.
Okay.
Well, my God.
Hi everyone, my name's Julia. I was a public defender in New York City for 8 years, and I practiced in Queens specifically. And as I saw on the timeline, Queens was one of the first places to have supervised release. The way I understand it, or I think the best way to explain it, is it's kind of like pre-trial probation. So you're, if you get arrested and charged with a crime, obviously you're considered innocent until proven guilty. And if it's a minor level crime, you very much might not be incarcerated while you're waiting for your trial. But these programs, instead of just saying, okay, you're released, come back to court, and that's it, these programs are becoming more heavily relied on, at least in my experience. And it basically makes you check in a lot. Like, you would have a supervised release officer who maybe you text them once a week, maybe you have to go in once a week. You might have to do alcohol treatment or community service kind of things. There's restrictions on your freedom from the moment of your arrest when these programs are put in place. So even though someone gets out when they're arrested and you're like, okay, great, you get to go home, there's still a lot of conditions on you. So I think of it as like probation kind of.
Amazing. Thank you, Julia. Was anyone else want to share anything in addition? Yeah.
Hi, my name's Dana. I am from Colorado Freedom Fund in Denver. And we have had a lot of increase in electronic monitoring and alcohol monitoring specifically. Even in cases where alcohol or drugs are not related to the case that somebody is accused of or related to. And then additionally, diversion courts, we've seen those are ways that people can supposedly have more freedom. And they also end up having a lot of those supervision, a lot of supposed accountability measures that end up being really intrusive in people's lives.
Thanks, Dana. And I want to, yeah, James, can you come up, please, as the expert?
Thank you, and thank you for this. I just want to talk a little bit about electronic monitoring. I also, I want to thank you for naming the fact that you're talking about New York, and we don't all live in New York, so we have to broaden our perspective and see how this applies in our local setting. My experience of electronic monitoring came when I was paroled from prison. I started off being only allowed out of the house Monday through Friday, 6 a.m. to 10 a.m., and so that really reshaped my idea of what it meant to be on electronic monitoring. And so since then, you know, we've seen the proliferation of this, as you've talked about in Colorado, and we've celebrated the, you know, a lot of the victories in Illinois. And just last week, the Office of Pretrial Services announced, without warning, that they were going to initiate electronic monitoring programs in 70 of the 102 counties in Illinois. So this, and I mean, I think people talk about electronic monitoring as an alternative to incarceration, but we consistently talk about it as being an alternative form of incarceration. You know, that it creates people, it turns people's houses into jails, into cages, and their families into jail staff. So, I mean, I think that's just something we have to be aware of, and the fact that these devices are also increasing their capacity, so they're able not only to track location, but capture biometrics and capture a lot of data, so they're a tool of the surveillance state as well.
Yeah. Thanks so much, James. And James is like a huge, yeah, do you want to come on up? We'll do one more and then I'll jump in. But James has been a challenging e-carceration is something everyone should check out. Huge leader.
I'm Alan. I'm from Milwaukee. In Milwaukee, we're getting a lot more of the e-carceration going on too, which ties in with what you're talking about with New York. We have Justice Point seems to be running a lot of that to keep hiring new people to do e-carceration caseloads. I think West Care is another big one that kind of does that. They're like now becoming the nonprofit middle managers of incarceration. It's like an additional layer. And then we got all your other standard things with diversionary courts, like the mental health ones or gun courts. But again, like, those are all coming with the supervision stipulations, even though you haven't actually officially been convicted of anything. They're already surveilling you. And these things just keep widening, the networks of surveillance. They're everywhere.
Thanks so much, Helen. Amazing. So obviously so many folks in this room have a lot of knowledge around this and your own experiences. And so what I'm going to walk through now is just to, again, do some level setting. It might be repetitive. We'll have more time for discussion, but I just really want to make sure we're on the same page. So everyone hopefully has access. There's a lot of extras around if you don't. There's handouts like on every other chair, but everyone should be able to have their own. And you'll see one, there's like with an image of a machine on the front. We were going to do slides, but found out we don't have a projector. So this is an image from a website that we at CJE created with Interrupting Criminalization and Critical Resistance called Beyond Courts. You can find it at beyondcourts.org. And the illustration was designed by Noah Jodice. Lots of great content on that website if you want to check it out. If you're interested in criminal court abolition, recommend it. But we put this here to give a picture, like a literal picture, of the path of a criminal case. So we're focusing on criminal cases today. We're not talking about civil court, not family court. A criminal court case includes, generally, the steps from arrest to sentencing, which you can see on the image. And these are pretty consistent across jurisdictions and across different types of charges, misdemeanors, felonies, et cetera. Today, we just wanted to call attention to this graphic because we're really going to be focusing on the types of, quote, you know, the alternative programs that are introduced during the pretrial period. So what happens after arrest and then before sentencing, even though we will talk about some alternatives to incarceration that are given at sentencing. But pretrial is between arrest and sentencing. You'll notice that we designed this image to look like a machine that people are churned through. Individual actors like cops and prosecutors and judges play key roles. They're like throwing people in. They're pushing the levers and the buttons. But also the machine has a life of its own. And it's fueled by and produces systems of oppression, which you see like the gas coming in and the exhaust coming out. If you turn the page and, yeah, look at the top. Yeah, thanks, Juan. The top graphic, my little Canva graphic. I thought it was easier to like kind of walk through and give definitions as we go as opposed to like just giving you a glossary or something. So the first step in this pretrial period after someone's arrested is the arraignment or the bail hearing. Depends on where you are. This is when the person who's arrested, you know, sees the judge or the magistrate for the first time. And the decision made at this point is like, will the case continue or will it end? If it ends, it's usually because the prosecutor has decided not to prosecute the person, so the charges are dismissed, or because typically for really minor crimes, the person is taking a plea deal. And that means they're being convicted through the plea deal. That can result in sentences ranging from like time served, which is basically like the arrest was enough, you're good. You can get a jail sentence, you can get an alternative to incarceration. Community service is really common at this point as an alternative, or like some kind of program, or you could be given a fine. If the case continues, the judge will decide, you know, with input from the defense attorney and the prosecutor, what's going to happen to you during this pretrial period. This is the bail decision. I think when we often hear bail, we think about money. That's what first comes to mind for a lot of folks. But bail actually refers to release. What is going to be the conditions of your release during the pretrial period, during that between the arrest and sentencing? And the options, as you see in the graphic, are like you can be released, which is sometimes called ROR, released on your own recognizance. Money bail or bond can be set. You can be what's called preventative detention or remand, which means you're just going to jail, or released with conditions. Okay, so then the graphic beneath it is just the continuation. If you are released or you have money bail set and you can afford it, you're going to be free during the pretrial period. We put an asterisk by free because, as anyone who's ever been through the court system or supported people through the court system, like with an ongoing criminal case, you're never really free. You have to continue coming back to court dates at least once a month. If you're stopped by a cop or arrested while the case is ongoing, you're much more likely to end up in jail. And you're still just like under the watchful eye of the system, even if you're like technically free. So we still understand like any part of criminal court as a form of social control. But like there are other layers to it. So if you do have bail set, you can't afford it, or you're given preventative detention, you're gonna be in a cage through the duration of your case. And then finally, you can be released with conditions. This means that you're gonna be under some form of explicit supervision or surveillance for the duration of your case. That can look like, as James was talking about, like an electronic shackle or monitor, house arrest, curfew, check-ins with a caseworker, or some kind of program. I mean, depending on where you are, the judge actually has a lot of discretion in what happens to you during this period. Again, even though you're not yet convicted of anything. And we consider both being caged and also being under supervision as forms of carceral control. So during this pretrial period, no matter what bail or release conditions the judge sets, your case is going to continue to be prosecuted. So this is where we're going to get it, like, what are diversion courts? What are specialty courts? Prosecution can look like the traditional way you'd imagine it. You go to court, you have a lawyer, your lawyer, the prosecutor, evidence is presented, like maybe how you imagine it from TV. But prosecutors and judges can also decide to prosecute certain cases differently by funneling the case into a problem-solving court. Sometimes it's referred to as a treatment court or a specialty court or a status court, or into a diversion program. Whether a case is eligible for these kinds of prosecution depends on the charge, the jurisdiction, and the discretion of the prosecuting office or the judge. Just like quickly, what makes these modes of prosecution different is that the person being prosecuted enters into and then must successfully complete some kind of program or requirements, like, for example, anger management class, mental health or drug treatment, restorative justice circles, community service, counseling, having to pay fines or fees. It's a wide range, but there's something they have to do in order to avoid a conviction or incarceration. And so, like, these programs, as folks were sharing in their examples, they're often presented as deals, bargains, you know, alternatives, but they actually really expand surveillance and supervision. They often come with, you often have to pay for them, and they extend the state's control over people's lives for years, and they just also are often a trap that leads you back into incarceration. Inpatient programs especially, like, they just feel like prison. But they're really tempting because, like, if you navigate all the requirements, you can avoid a criminal record or prison time. Okay, so prosecution then can end in two ways. Either the case is dismissed or you're found not guilty, or you're convicted. And when you're convicted, sentences can range from prison time, fines, probation, or alternatives to incarceration programs. Okay, so for, like, all that being said, that was a lot. But for the purposes of today's session, all the stuff circled in red that Matt and I circled are the things we're going to be talking about today. And we just wanted to give you that level setting to be like, just so you know what we mean when we're saying alternatives as a shorthand. We're referring to pretrial supervision and surveillance, diversion programs, specialty or problem-solving courts, and alternatives to incarceration. I didn't mention this, but others did as they shared examples. Like, these can be run by nonprofits, they can be run by the courts, they can be private that you are paying for. We don't distinguish between who's running them as long as they're affiliated with the courts. And one thing we, just one other limitation or just a caveat is that, like Julia was talking about these types of programs as, what did you say? They're like probation and the, yeah. So the reason people use probation as a shorthand is like we all, most of us probably know what probation is. We don't talk about it in this, even though it is like very similar to all these programs. It laid the groundwork for all these programs. It has a much longer history, and people in movements or even reformists, like mainstream people, are not asking for more probation because we already associate it as a carceral thing, as associated with the cage. And so for us, we were focusing on the kinds of things that people in movements, even mainstream people, even reformists, are asking for, see more as an alternative. So just a caveat of why we didn't focus on probation, even though it's totally connected to all of this. It's like laid the groundwork for everything. Okay.
We're going to have an activity next, but in addition to what Rachel just said, we also don't necessarily focus on parole, but both of these were, you know, are also sites of reform. We're really focused on the pretrial part of this, partially because of what we shared about our own backgrounds in like doing like anti-jail expansion work and like cash bail, kind of like anti-cash bail organizing. One thing I'm curious about before we get into the timeline activity is how many people have heard the demand like care not cops? So another way to think about everything we just shared is that we're really trying to figure out like what does that mean? Just like so many people here, like what does CARE reference? And if CARE references different kinds of coercive programs, then we need to like figure out what else to demand.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.